Lecture 5, Freud's Psychodynamic Theory.
Hello. In the last few lectures, we covered the early history of the development of child study and our sense of how children develop the conceptions of children. In this lecture today, and for the next two lectures, we're going to talk about Freud's theory. Freud is the first theorist, then, that we'll cover in detail. And today we'll talk about his basic energy model and the drives and the way these drives meet adaptive needs of individuals. In this first developmental theory of Freud's, we talk about what's called a psychodynamic theory. Now, it's called psychodynamic because it focuses on dynamic psychological processes, mainly unconscious processes. In the sense of being dynamic, it's always moving. It's always being used. And the reason that Freud came up with this theory was to try to explain how we adapt and then constantly readapt to our environment and also to cope with various conflicts we have, issues that come up and conflicts that come up from within as well as those that come from without. Now, whether one accepts Freud's theory or not, and I have to say that most psychologists today don't hold him in high regard, although there are a lot of therapists around who still use Freudian concepts and Freudian theory to guide their work. But whether you hold him in high regard or not, his concepts have become so internalized into our thinking to the point now that implicitly we have his theory with us all the time. It influences our thinking about human nature. We cannot escape Freud. It's become part of our culture and part of our thinking. And in this way, then, you have to say that Freud revolutionized the sense of human nature and certainly revolutionized psychology. When Freud first espoused his theory, it was really seen as an outrageous and actually a dangerous theory. But its influence increased over time, and despite the initial strong rejection and the disbelief of many theorists, it did have this strong revolutionary effect. You think about why it was rejected. Well, Freud came up with some pretty strong ideas, talking about infantile sexuality, about sex being the main drive, the main motivation that drove everything. Even the things he says, even today, seem a little bit touchy and outrageous today. Think of how this hit people in Victorian Vienna, a very uptight and proper society. And he was just smacking them in the face with these extreme views of things. In fact, his theory probably came about as a reaction to the extremity of that society at the time. Probably one reason for its strong influence was, though, because in spite of it being touchy and sensitive and bothering people, Freud's theory so systematically unified many aspects of human nature, and it talked about questions that we had. It talked about things that simply had not been explained or discussed before or brought into a unity of a theory. The most important point was unconscious processing. Now, people knew there was an unconscious. They talked about the unconscious. But Freud, for the first time, brought unconscious processing to the forefront of our thinking and really talked about how it might work. So ever since Freud, we can now never go back to thinking we don't have unconscious processes, and they're a major part of who we are as humans. He changed that forever. He also explained, this is an interesting aspect of what he did, he explained the current problems that a person has by systematically linking them to our past or to a person's past developmental history. So, what a revolutionary idea, that maybe the problems you have might stem from the problems you had in childhood or the problems you had with your parents. You see how common that is, how obvious that seems to us today, and it wasn't when Freud came along and brought this about. He tied a lot of aspects of human relationships together, how one relationship might relate to another kind of relationship. He explained a lot of aspects of motivation, little understood aspects of motivation. For example, we feel mixed emotions and mixed motivations. We want to do one thing, but we want to do something else. We want to really do something, but we don't do it. Why is that? And we have these mixed motivations. Usually we're not even conscious of all the motivations. We're not even conscious of all of our emotions. Those are the kinds of issues that Freud dealt with. And he described our defensiveness, when we get very defensive in dealing with or talking about some aspect. He also described neuroses. Now, the physicians of the time knew that there were neuroses, but he tried to explain them in a systematic way. He explained the functions of dreams as they had never been explained before. And in fact, despite his theory being old now in terms of the massive amount of research on sleep and dreaming, he still did a pretty good job. Even today, we talk about dreams as being ways that we work out issues or problems or go over things that we need to understand, stuff like that that came from Freud. So Freud's theory had a lot of extremely valuable and revolutionary aspects to it. In Freud's theory, he meant to focus on how the entire personality develops. He wanted to show how we adapt to reality, how we develop disorders and psychopathologies. But he also was very much interested in how we treat disorders. Remember, he was really a therapist, a physician. So there are a lot of aspects of his theory that deal with treatment, with therapy, with disorders that I'm not going to talk about in these lectures. I want to focus on some aspects of his theory that apply to child development. And those are the aspects, then, that are important for us. I have to go back for a minute, though. Initially, when we started these lectures, I said that to understand human nature, it's important to understand the origins, where we came from, and the process of how we develop. In fact, that's exactly what Freud did. He wanted to understand problems. He wanted to understand human nature. But in order to do that, he had to talk about origins, about development. He saw the necessity of talking about child development, how we got from our beginnings to where we are. He was a revolutionary thinker. Have I made that clear? But he was also a product of his times. So a lot of his thinking you can trace to the things that influenced him. Let me give you a little bit of Freud's history. He was born in 1856 in Moravia, which was then a part of Austria. He lived most of his life in Vienna. And later on, he became a refugee to Nazism. He escaped to England in 1938 with his family. And he died just a year later in 1939 in England. Being Jewish, Freud was exposed to strong anti-Semitic prejudices in Europe at that time. And it's very likely that these prejudices in part colored many of his views about human nature. Freud had somewhat of a negative view of humans. They were tough. They were trying to adapt, but it wasn't what you'd call entirely positive, and he saw a lot of that around him. He received his M.D. degree in 1888, despite the fact that there was prejudice against him getting it, and he became a practicing physician rather than a neurological researcher. It seems like he wanted to be a scientist, be a researcher, but the financial necessities required that he make some money, and he became a practitioner. He also seemed, from what he says, everything you can learn about him, he seemed to have this very strong motivation to have an impact on the scientific and medical community. It was biased against him. He wanted to prove himself. And this may have been one of the drives that he had. He was also influenced greatly by three areas of science as he understood them, as people understood them at that time. So first, he came from a medical background. And it was his current understanding of medicine, and with it, neurology and mental processes, that influenced the way he thought about human development and human nature. And because of this focus of the time, He was influenced by researchers and physicians who were experimenting with new types of therapy. So he got in with some people who were experimenting with hypnotism as a new way of doing therapy with people. He experimented with new drugs. We didn't have a drug culture, a medical culture that we do today. But, for example, he experimented with cocaine, thought was a miracle drug, until he learned that there were some bad side effects. He tried to understand the brain and its functioning, and he thought of himself as a neurologist in part, that he was tying his theory to neurology. However, it was a pretty lousy knowledge at the time. It was not the level we have today. I don't think people today would say it ties really well with what we currently know about neurology. So his first area of influence was this medical community. His second major area of influence were the energy models that were current in theories and research in physics. At that time, it seems that energy was a big focus, was the issue. And he was very much taken by a hydraulic energy model. The idea is people were focusing on energy to try to explain a lot of aspects of science and of nature. And energy was seen as something that could be transformed from one type of energy into another. It could be used in different ways. When I talk about a hydraulic energy model, I mean that people saw energy in a system, almost like a boiler system or a heating system, energy that could be transferred through pipes, if you will, or through some source, from one source to another, energy that was conserved, even though it was used for different purposes. And this influenced Freud. And we'll come back to that, because today we are going to talk about his energy model. His third major area of influence was was Darwin's theory of evolution. I think all scientists were influenced by evolution. But in particular, this concept that humans had evolved processes and functions that helped them to adapt, to survive, and reproduce was very important for Freud. You see, these processes became prominent in his conceptualization of his own theory, that we have evolved to be able to adapt and to survive. So let me go back now to this energy model, because his theory was based on an idea of energy and of drive reduction as a model. First, with energy. Freud actually believed that there was some kind of energy that ran all of our psychological processes. Now, he couldn't measure it. He didn't know where it was. But I don't think in this case, and Freud used a lot of metaphors, but in this case, I think he actually believed there was an energy system, this form of energy. It wasn't electrical, but it was some form. He called it psychic energy. Today, the word psychic has all kinds of connotations. If Freud were around today, he would have called it psychological energy. He didn't mean psychic, ESP. He meant psychological. And this psychic energy, or psychological energy, was used to run all of our processing. And he gave this energy a name. He called it the libido. Now, Freud always named everything, which makes it really easy to keep to hang on to his theory. It also makes it a little strange, because everything starts taking sort of a personal quality, these metaphors he used. He called the energy libido. And I want to mention that because we have used the word libido so much that it has different connotations than the way Freud initially started with it. I've heard people say, that guy has a strong libido, and they mean he has a strong sex drive. But when Freud started, libido was simply the basic energy that a person needed to meet his biological needs and to deal with the challenges from the environment. And Freud believed also that individuals are born with instinctual drives. Instinctual drives that you always have with you that use this energy, or the energy is used within these drives, again, to meet your needs and to adapt. Now, in his model, a drive is activated when we have a particular need, and that need causes discomfort or irritation. It was really sort of a negative irritation model. The perfect example is hunger. You have a low blood sugar level. And this is translated neurologically into hunger pangs. You feel discomfort. And this motivates you to meet your need. You want to go out and eat to get something inside. If you eat and try to meet your need then and take action, this reduces your need and it also reduces your drive. And therefore, this kind of approach is called a drive reduction model for motivation. In fact, a lot of motivation today still uses this model, using hunger or thirst as sort of an example of how we're motivated. Motivation has gone beyond just drive reduction, but this is still around. Some of the psychic energy or this libido is channeled into these different drives to meet these needs to reduce drive states. And so in this sense, the organism adapts to the demands of the environment and also to the biological demands of the organism. There are two main drives in humans, as Freud saw it. And the first of these drives he called Eros. And this was a drive that was based on striving for sexual pleasure, survival, and reproduction. So as many people have said, this drive was seen as a life-affirming drive, a positive drive by Freud. And he thought that the Eros, this sexual drive, pervaded most of what we're motivated to do. This was the main drive. Now, I want to mention something about sex for Freud. For Freud, sex was in everything because this was the primary drive that motivated us, where the energy was used to meet needs, to deal with conflicts and challenges. But for Freud, so much was included in sex that in some ways he sort of watered it down. So when he talks about sex and the sex drive, he doesn't just mean the sexual act as we talk about. Everything that we would call sensual or pleasure-seeking, he would call sexual. If I scratch my arm, I guess for Freud that would be sexual. If I'm hungry and I want to go get a hamburger, I guess that's sort of sexual. I'm probably putting words in his mouth. But you see, sex includes a lot of things. So when he talked about babies even babies being highly sexual beings, he didn't mean that they had adult levels of sexual conceptualizations or were even aware of adult intercourse or sexual acts. He didn't mean that. He meant that everything is sort of this sexual drive for pleasure. The second main drive, besides Eros, was what he called Thanatos. And this was a drive that was based on a striving for a complete static equilibrium. If the Eros was life-affirming and there to gain pleasure and to survive, Thanatos was to seek absolute equilibrium even in bodily functions. And at one point, Freud said, the ultimate equilibrium is death. Everything goes into equilibrium. And so Freud thought we actually had a drive that led us towards our own destruction and our own death. Interestingly, Freud came up with the Thanatos drive later in his career, in his development. And it seems a lot of what he has observed in his life, suicides, the self-destructive behaviors of others, the war that was going on, the problems of the Holocaust, in part led probably to his conceptualization. But this drive is seen in self-destructive behaviors and also in aggression toward others. Now, for Freud, we can't escape these drives. They're inborn. They're always with us throughout life. We start with them as babies, and then we go on to have them later on. I'd like to give you a model for these drives, and I have to sort of paint this picture here. Picture, if you will, this big boiler pot. And it's being heated up. And inside this big iron pot is filled with a liquid that's really getting under pressure and is active and boiling away. Now, think of this boiler pot as our pot of libido, of psychic energy. And on one side of it, you have a pipe going out with a spigot. And we'll call this Eros. And you can drain off some of this psychic energy and use it for different purposes. And on the other side of the pot, you have another pipe going out and a spigot, and this is Thanatos. And you can drain off this psychic energy, this libido, and use it in that way. So Freud used all kinds of personifications. I will too. Think of this boiler pot model then as libido with the various drives that use the energy. Because it was a hydraulic model, also keep in mind that you could change around energy. You could use it in one way and then reuse it in another way. Some of it was drained off for one purpose. Some of it would be drained off for another purpose. The libido and the drive, though, have to be somewhere if you use my boiler pot model. And so Freud said they reside in the unconscious processes of the neural system. These unconscious processes Freud called, that hold the libido, Freud called the id. So we've all heard of the famous id. Now, it's interesting. In the original German, it was called the S, the it. I think it's a better term than id. But the id, or the it part of us, refers to that unconscious part of the person, those basic animal functions that we're born with, the basic needs and drives to keep us alive, keep us seeking pleasure. So, for example, a baby's born. The baby has an itch and wants to scratch. It expects gratification on demand. It's unconscious. Has to scratch the itch. Baby's hungry. The baby wants to be fed, wants that irritation, if you will, that hunger taken away. So the processes of the id are basically amoral and irrational. Amoral, I didn't say immoral. The id is amoral. It doesn't care. It just has basic needs. And because all of these processes are unconscious, we're really not aware of them or how they drive us, at least most of the time, at least until Freud came along and tried to get us in touch with these unconscious processes. But we really didn't know what was, they're just there. These processes are also so unrealistic that they really don't take count of reality or means-end relationships. When I say means-end relationships, we don't take account of what we need to do in one case to bring about some cause or some effect. We're not, the id doesn't do that. The id doesn't function that way. We can meet our needs by investing libido and bringing about certain ends, but we're not sure how we do that. So Freud said we're born with this kind of processing, and he called it primary process thinking. Primary only because this is the first process that we have. In primary process thinking, which is really how the id works, we're just automatically and unconsciously trying to meet our needs. A baby is hungry, and it sucks. And very often, milk goes down, and it feels good. There's no conscious thought. There's no planning on the baby's part. The baby has an itch. It cries. The baby has a wet diaper. It feels uncomfortable. It cries. Very often, because of the help of somebody else, often, baby's needs are met. Okay? However, very often in our life, and you should know now, any adult should know this, probably a good share of the time, we don't have all our needs met. And we certainly don't have met the minute we have those needs and the minute we feel some irritation or drive. So in these cases, we still attempt to meet our needs, but if all we have is an id, an unconscious irrational process, we really don't do a very good job of meeting them. And Freud then argued that we also fantasize about meeting our needs, that we try to gain this pleasure and meet our needs and fulfill them through fantasy thinking, not in reality, but through fantasy. So when a baby's hungry, it wants to get milk, it sucks. The baby cries. If nothing happens, babysitter's not paying attention, then the baby fantasizes about sucking milk. And this fantasizing is a compensation, if you will. It compensates for not really having the need met. And Freud called this wish fulfillment. Now, I have to say that I have a criticism of Freud's theory here. He talked about babies having wish fulfillment and fantasies at a level that attributes to them a very high level of symbolic processing, of being able to keep things in the mind, to represent things in the mind. And from what we know now, what we've learned since Freud's times about kids, there isn't a lot of evidence that kids have this level of symbolic processing until it develops in the second year of life and then fully develops beyond. So in some ways, Freud really didn't seem to know babies all that well. You could say it was just a mistake of the time. He attributed a lot of you might say, sophisticated cognitive abilities to kids that we're not sure they have. For example, he said babies would dream sometimes about somebody breaking into a room. And this was really a memory of when they were in utero and their parents were having sexual intercourse, and it scared them. Well, it's hard to imagine that they really knew that was happening when they were in utero, but even if they did, how did they process that and symbolize it to keep representing it later? So he made a lot of attributions that we're not so sure about. Having said that, though, we can criticize him, but there's still some truth to this idea of wish fulfillment in some ways. Adults, especially as kids get older, or adults, if you look at adults, you can say wish fulfillment is still with us, and in Freud's terms, it's part of our unconscious. We have fantasies about, let's say, a love partner, and we dream about sex. All of these might be wish fulfillments. We're not really meeting our needs, but we have these fantasies. But these needs go unfulfilled. So the entire primary processing that's based on this idea called the pleasure principle. In Freud's view, we're trying to seek pleasure and avoid pain and discomfort. The pleasure principle is very much associated with primary processing. But it's not very adaptive because we're not going to meet our needs a lot of the time, and wish fulfillment just doesn't put milk in your belly. It doesn't really meet your needs. It's no wonder that babies wouldn't survive without their parents being around. Something else is needed. And in fact, we're going to talk about next time some of the ways that then the id further develops or other processes break off the ego and eventually the superego to meet the needs and be more adaptive. Before I leave, though, let me give you one case of wish fulfillment that I think really shows it working, that Freud was onto something. And this is a true story. By the way, when I tell stories, they're true. These are things that actually happen. There was a girl, a family I know, and the parents, she was a preschooler. She was about three at the time, three and a half. And her parents went through a separation, and they eventually got a divorce. And she did something that kids, in situations like this when the parents get a divorce, that kids very often do. In her pretend play, she sort of worked out or played at the issue that was of concern to her. And this is hard to believe, but in the same kid this happened, at one time she pretended that she had a doll family. And the doll family was driving around in cars, the members of the family were driving around in cars, and they were spread all over the world in her pretend play, and she couldn't get them back together. It was a very distressing, sort of negative kind of play situation. Now, if you're a Freudian, it doesn't take much work to see that she's acting out an issue or a conflict or problem that she actually had. And Freud and people that followed him said in play, as in other areas of life, we often have what's called a repetition compulsion. We have a compulsion to repeat the same negative things. It doesn't seem to make sense, but some way we're trying to work it out. We're trying to work out these issues. We're not necessarily conscious of what we're doing. She wasn't conscious of this. Later on, she pretended that the family got back together. So she went around and she gathered them up, and they all became united again as a family. In real life, this did not happen. Her parents did not get back together. But in her pretend play, they did. And Freud and others who talk about pretend play in kids talk about wish fulfillment. There's repetition compulsion, and there's wish fulfillment. It's a compensation for this kid of bringing about what she wants, but it's not real. Now, you could say that wish fulfillment is not adaptive, but sometimes in our life, such as in pretend play of kids, it might be adaptive in the sense that at least it helps you to cope while your needs are not really being met. And I think it worked that way for this kid. So next lecture we'll talk about the further development of this adaptive process. Thank you.